Good morning. My name is Andy Schoenholtz. I'm a professor here at the law school. I want to welcome all of you. This is the 9th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference. Georgetown Law is delighted once again to partner with the Migration Policy Institute, the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, and the Center for Migration Studies to offer you an excellent program on the major immigration law and policy issues of the day. Georgetown is committed in many ways to this field. We offer students clinical, practicum, seminar, and lecture courses, as well as the Certificate in Refugees and Humanitarian Emergencies, which enables them to concentrate in our field. We help students connect to many of you in this audience, our advocacy, practitioner, governmental, and international governmental colleagues, through externships, internships, and employment after graduation. So I'm pleased to welcome all the Georgetown students here, as well as all the colleagues who engage in these issues day in, day out. There are many people to thank. Here at Georgetown, Kiana Graham, our the Assistant Director of Special Events, took the lead on all the logistics here at the law school. I want also to thank Kara Terschel, the Director of Media Relations, for publicizing this event. Maura Moser, who many of you have met outside, is Clinic's Chief of Staff and took the lead on organizing our planning team and many logistical and administrative matters. Lisa Dixon, MPI's Senior Events Manager, played an invaluable role in a variety of ways, including helping engage many of our panelists and speak. Many helped with setting the agenda and finding the best speakers and panelists, including Doris Meisner, Michelle Mittelstadt, Don Kerwin, Maria Odom, before she was plucked away by USCIS, and Allison Posner. It's a fabulous group to work with, and I'm delighted we're back again this year. And now I'd like to ask one of the leading experts in our field, Doris Meisner, to come to the podium to introduce our first speaker. Doris?
Thank you, Andy. Let me also join in welcoming everybody here to this year's conference. My name is Doris Meisner at the Migration Policy Institute, and as Andy said, we're one of the co-sponsoring institutions for this annual event, which is now getting to be a real tradition. It's my particular pleasure this morning to be able to introduce our keynote speaker, Tom Perez, the Assistant Attorney General of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Now, Tom brings to this position an incredible career devoted to public service in many, many different places. He's been in the state of Maryland, served as the Secretary of the Department of Labor there. He's been an elected official, having served on the county council in Montgomery County. He's been on the Hill, where he was special counsel to the late Senator Kennedy. He headed up the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Health and Human Services. So he has seen government and public policy from lots of different vantage points. He's also seen the Civil Rights Division from lots of vantage points, because he was a career attorney in the Civil Rights Division for many, many years, also served in an earlier life as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Civil Rights Division. So this is a background that is almost unparalleled in terms of the responsibilities that he now holds. And that is particularly relevant, it seems to me, because the Civil Rights Division is a very special place. The Civil Rights Division is the place in our government that is charged with protecting and upholding some of our most critical core constitutional principles: equality under the law, fair treatment for all. In pursuing those ideals, it has a storied history of hard-won victories that represent some of our proudest achievements as a society. It's also, of course, though, also experienced low points, where the enforcement of anti-discrimination laws and protecting the most vulnerable among us have not fared so well. Thankfully, this is not one of those periods. Instead, when the history of this period is written, I believe it will rank among the high watermarks of the proud record the Civil Rights Division has established over the years. That will be in significant part due to the leadership that Tom Perez is providing and the work that he and his colleagues are doing in the realm of immigrant rights. From challenging SB 1070 and the Supreme Court's decision in Arizona versus the United States, to building a case against Sheriff Arpaio's enforcement practices in Arizona, Tom's leadership has been a profile in leaning forward in every way that he can. So we are extremely pleased that he's here today to tell us more about that work. Please join me in giving Tom a warm welcome of thanks and appreciation.
Good morning. Come on, it's Monday morning. Let's go. Let's do some exercise. Doris, thank you for your kind introduction. Doris Meisner is one of my heroes. When I think about immigration issues, immigration policy, immigration law, I can't think of somebody more learned than Doris Meisner. Not only her knowledge of the INA, that's only one small part of why I have such profound admiration for Doris. It's the passion and the compassion with which she approaches this work. And whenever I have a question about a tough issue, one of the first people I pick up the phone and call is Doris Meisner. One of the first organizations I pick up the phone and call is the Migration Policy Institute, because it is so important to make decisions based on evidence and facts, and not simply on anecdotes and ideology. And that is what Doris has done. That's what all of the hosts today have done. I want to thank Georgetown University for hosting this very, very important conference. I was looking earlier today at the plan of attack for today, and it really illustrated for me two things, because I was reviewing the agenda. And in particular, I was reviewing the panels, and then I had an opportunity just a few minutes ago to say hello to some old friends here, people I've known from local government, people I've known from national issues. And one of my favorite people, a person I have such profound respect for, is on one of the early panels, the Attorney General of Utah, Mark Shurtleff. And you look at these panels, and for me, it's a reminder as we start this day of two things. Immigration should be and has been and will be in 2013 a bipartisan issue. I look at Mark Shurtleff, and I appreciate that applause, because I think it's something that we need to be mindful of. You're my new best friend, okay? You know, I've had the privilege of getting to know Attorney General Shurtleff over the last 2-3 years, and he embodies everything you want in a public servant. And I say that as someone who we have had many conversations. Some of them have been difficult, but they have always been respectful. There has always been a shared interest in finding common ground. There has always been a recognition of our history as a nation of welcoming immigrants. And I look at this panel and I see other people like that. You're going to get to meet Ale Mayorkas. You're going to get to meet Seth Grossman. You already have here Doris Meisner. And there are so many other people who embody that spirit. And so as we begin today, I think it's important to remind ourselves of those two things. And Mark, you embody that as much as Mr. Attorney General, I should say. I apologize. You embody that as much as anyone in this room. And I know that President Obama, Attorney General Holder, and others in this administration want nothing more than comprehensive immigration reform. And I know that with people like you, that possibility would have much more chance of being a reality. And I want to thank you for the work that you have done. And secondly, as I was looking at this agenda for today, I think it's also important to remind ourselves of history, because there's a tendency as we debate SB 1070, as we talk about the merits of other immigration laws across the country, there is a tendency to say, oh my goodness, what has happened to us? What is going on? And actually, the issues of immigrant integration are as old as this nation. The fights that we have had about immigration, the passionate battles that we have had about immigration, are very, very old. They really go back to the founding of the Republic. As Dr. King has said many times, the arc of our nation bends toward justice. And in the area of immigration, I have, and I come here today, with a profound reservoir of optimism that the arc of history on immigration will indeed bend toward justice. And I come to this with a sense of optimism, not because I've got my head in the sand or I am pathologically and naively optimistic, but I come to this with a sense of optimism because I look at our nation's history. I look at the people before us for centuries who came together to help immigrants. I was in Baltimore last week speaking at a conference on immigrant immigration. I spent a lot of time with the assistance of the Migration Policy Institute looking at the contributions of immigrants in Maryland. We learned about the ancient hoarder of Hibernians established in the early 1800s to assist Irish immigrants. We learned about the German Society of Maryland established in the late 1700s to help German immigrants. So many other groups. I was the board president of CASA Maryland in the late 90s, doing work that was indistinguishable, I am confident, from the German Society of Maryland and the ancient order of Hibernians, a long and proud history of immigrant integration, not simply in Maryland, but across this country as we move forward. And it's important to keep a sense of that history. And there is an important part of that history that we must also reflect on, and that is the history of movements that were against immigration. No more perhaps pronounced than the Know Nothing movement of the mid-19th century. And as someone who was raised Catholic and goes to a church about a half a mile from here, it's remarkable to reflect on the Know Nothing movement of the late 1800s, the mid-1800s, I should say, and the work that they did to, quote-unquote, Americanize America. That was what they did. They captured legislatures and governorships in Connecticut, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, even Maryland had a period of time where the Know Nothing movement was a big part of what they were doing. And it was remarkable to see after they captured the governorship and state legislature in Massachusetts, they passed laws dismissing Catholic state workers, banning foreign language instruction in public schools, very active in opposing immigrants, very active in opposing Catholics. And when I spoke to the Islamic Society of North America just a few weeks ago, I again reminded them of this history. And part of this history is to remember that the Know Nothing movement fizzled. And it fizzled because people around this room, people of various faiths, people across the ideological spectrum, grassroots, grass tops, business leaders and others came together and said, this is not America. They came together and they said, E Pluribus Unum is not simply some hollow Latin phrase. It is a value statement for our nation. And they remembered that, and they continued to put that in action, and that's why the Know Nothing movement fizzled. And that's why we have, from the beginning of our time, so many immigrants who have contributed so much to our nation's fabric, as you well know. Immigrants have been serving the armed forces since the Revolutionary War. Legal immigrants have been making the ultimate sacrifice for this nation since the Revolutionary War. As you know, one of the first fatalities in the most recent war in Iraq was an immigrant from Guatemala who was originally undocumented, had his status adjusted, made the ultimate sacrifice, and got his citizenship posthumously. My uncle was so proud to show his scar on his leg from service for the United States Army in World War II, a legal immigrant from the Dominican Republic for whom this country gave us opportunity. And he was so willing to serve, as were my other uncles, the United States Army, as a legal immigrant. And they tell the story with great fondness about the day that the commanding officer said, "Who wants to become a citizen?" And they all became citizens that day. And so it's important to remind ourselves of our history, the history of immigration, the history of immigrant integration, the history of anti-immigrant sentiment, and the history of those bipartisan efforts to overcome the anti-immigrant sentiment that from time to time has reared its ugly head. Because we are indeed a land of opportunity, and in the Civil Rights Division, we are indeed in the opportunity business. I have had the great privilege and the solemn obligation of leading the Civil Rights Division over the last 3 years. It has indeed been an honor. And there are so many opportunities here. We are, again, as I said, in the business of building opportunity and expanding opportunity. And the reality is while we have made so much progress as a nation, opportunity gaps persist. And we see those opportunity gaps in so many different walks of life, in so many different areas of our work. We see opportunity gaps in education. My parents taught my siblings and I that education is the great equalizer, and if you get that chance to move up and get that higher education, that you will indeed have the opportunity to realize all of your dreams. My dad worked himself quite literally to an early grave. He died when I was 12 years old. He had just taken on a second job so that he could pay the college tuition. I was the youngest of five, and in order to make ends meet, that's what they did. But they were able to persist, and we were able to persist. And so, actually, all my siblings are doctors. I promised I'd never become a plaintiff's personal injury lawyer, and I kept that promise. And I feel very blessed about the opportunities that I have. And I've helped my brother once or twice, giving him guidance. And he loves lawyers when they get him out of trouble. But that's an aside for the break, and we'll talk about that later. But you know what? I have had a charmed life because that educational foundation that was laid for me and the opportunities I had. But too many people across America do not have equal educational opportunity. Too many kids who are limited English proficient are lacking access to equal educational opportunity. And that's why we have worked with the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights to do cases for English language learners in Massachusetts and Arizona and elsewhere to expand opportunity by enforcing civil rights laws that give that opportunity to English language learners. That is why we have other education cases pending involving kids who can't learn because they can't exist in a safe environment. If the environment is not safe, students can't learn. If a student is walking around a corner and not sure if he's going to get beaten up, then that's not a safe and healthy learning environment. Our bullying docket has taken off, and the bullying that we see has so many different faces to it. You go to South Philadelphia High School, Asian students who were repeatedly, not simply verbally harassed, but physically beaten. One day, over a dozen had to go to the emergency room as a result of persistent abuse that was not rectified by the school administration. And so we worked with the school system to build a learning environment in which all students can have that opportunity to learn. Students in suburban Minneapolis who are Somali American, who were told, go back to your home country, you terrorist. This is their home, the United States of America. And we worked with that school district to make sure that they could have equal educational opportunity. Kids in Alabama, and we were very troubled in our investigation in the immediate aftermath of the passage of HB 56 to learn about anecdotes involving Latino students who were being bullied. And we have worked with the school systems down there. We've worked with teachers down there. We've worked with parents down there. We've worked with administrators down there to make sure that equal educational opportunity exists for everybody in Alabama. I took an oath to uphold the Constitution and laws of the United States. And 30 years ago, the Supreme Court, in the landmark decision of Plyler versus Doe, declared that every child living in America has a right to a free K-12 public education in the public school system, regardless of their immigration status. The Plyler decision represents a deeply held American ideal. It's an ideal that my parents certainly taught me, and it's the ideal that all young people deserve the chance to advance as far as their hard work and initiative and talents will take them. And this past summer, when we marked the 30th anniversary, we sent out with our colleagues at the Department of Education guidance to all school systems that Plyler remains the law of the land and we have the obligation to continue to enforce it. And the reason we sent that letter out was not simply to mark an anniversary, but because we had seen problems in school districts. And in Alabama, for instance, in the aftermath of the passage of HB 56, we saw troubling evidence that Latino kids were dropping out of school. And let me give you one data point. Here's one audience participation round. What percentage of students in the Alabama public school system are U.S. citizens? You want to take a guess? Anyone? 3%. Shout it out.
3%.
95. You would be incorrect. You're too low. 99% of students in the Alabama public schools are U.S. citizens. That is an utterly irrelevant statistic, by the way, because under Plyler, every student who is living in Alabama and is a resident in Alabama has the right to a public school education. But I bring it up to note that the victims in the aftermath of the Plyler decision were overwhelmingly U.S. citizen kids living in oftentimes mixed status families. And what we found was a dramatic increase in absenteeism and dropouts among Latino students. Absences among Alabama's Latino students tripled after the law went into effect, while staying flat for other groups of students. Withdrawals spiked as much as 13%, more than 13% of the state's Latino students left school. And so we continued to collect that data. We continued to document that data, and we continued to report on that data. And as a result, if you look at the opinion of the 11th Circuit in the case filed by private plaintiffs, those data points were cited by that court in striking down Section 28 of HB 56, which was the Plyler-like provision. And so we saw that work. We continue to make sure that educational opportunity exists, whether it's working in Alabama, whether it's working in Arizona, whether it's working for ELL students, whether it's working for students who have been bullied, whether it's working in any educational context to make sure that educational gaps are eliminated and everybody has the opportunity that I feel privileged to have had to get a fair shake in education. But our opportunity gaps that we see in the Civil Rights Division are not limited to education. We see the persistent opportunity gaps in elsewhere, including access to basic safety, basic public safety. There's an undeniable headwind of intolerance in certain parts of America that's rearing its ugly head in the prevalence of hate crimes. Our hate crimes activity, our prosecutions have moved up dramatically in the past couple years. And undeniably, immigrants have a bullseye on their back. Muslims, Arabs, Sikhs, and South Asians have a bullseye on their back all too frequently. We see the work that we have done. Examples are all too prevalent. The case we did in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, involving a Mexican national sitting in the park with his girlfriend, beaten to death by a group of teenagers simply because he was a Mexican national and they didn't like the fact that Mexicans had moved in to their area. And to make matters worse, the first responders in that case included the de facto stepfather of one of the assailants. And so trial number one was the hate crime trial of the assailants. Trial number two was the cover-up trial of the police officers, including the chief of police. Convictions in trial one, convictions in trial two. This is all too frequently what we see across America, whether it is the South Asian couple walking along Lake Tahoe, assaulted simply because of who they were, whether it was the young man, Mr. Ramirez, in Shenandoah, whether it is the heads of the NCLR, LULAC, MALDEF, and other immigrant rights organizations who were threatened repeatedly over the internet by an individual who called himself Devilfish. Imagine coming into your office in the morning and getting an email. You turn on your computer, and the first thing is, I want to kill you. You should die. You will die. Because you had the audacity to stand up like the Ancient Order of Hibernians and the German Society of Maryland and elsewhere. You had the audacity to do the same thing. Well, we prosecuted Devilfish as well, and he's having a lot of time to reflect on his repeated use of the internet, and he won't be using the internet anytime soon and anytime ever. But that, regrettably, is what we see across America. Access to safety is elusive for so many people across this country. And we see in our work with police departments the importance of ensuring that police departments are effective and constitutional. There's often this false dichotomy that's created. You can either protect the Constitution or protect public safety. Reject that false dichotomy, because that is indeed false. We can have safe streets and constitutional policing. They go hand in hand, and we're working with police departments across the country. And let me tell you a few examples of things that occurred quite literally within the last 10 days. We spend a lot of time in New Orleans. I've spent as much time in New Orleans as any city in America. We're working hard to reform the criminal justice system. Some horrific things happen to people, people across many races, African Americans, Latinos, Vietnamese people, as a result of some dramatic systems failures of the New Orleans Police Department. And to their credit, they came to us at the beginning of Mayor Mitch Landrieu's tenure and said, we need help. And so we came in there, and we diagnosed the problem. We peeled the onion to its core in what was the largest and most extensive investigation of a police department that was ever done. And we came together with the community, with the police department, with the rank-and-file officers on a far-ranging consent decree. And we had what's called a fairness hearing 10 days ago, a hearing in which community people can come in and give their opinions on the consent decree that was reached. And there was remarkable testimony by two leaders, emerging leaders in the immigrant communities, because New Orleans has had a remarkable uptick in immigration, especially in the aftermath of Katrina. And we heard from two people in the Latino community, because our report documented that limited English proficient people in New Orleans were having very serious difficulty accessing public safety services. And one of the people who came in to testify told us her story and told the court her story. She had a 3-month-old child. She was involved in a domestic dispute with her husband. The police were ultimately summoned. She and her husband are limited English proficient. The police came to the door. They spoke no English, or they spoke no Spanish. They were unable to communicate. She had a 3-month baby at home. The upshot was she got arrested, and she was jailed for 45 days. No charges filed. Ultimately released. But imagine being the parent of a 3-month-old child, and you are separated from that child unnecessarily and unconstitutionally for 45 days. And she had the courage to come in and tell the court her story. And she was asked, what do you want to see change? And she said, I want the police to treat our community with respect. That's what she said. And I want to come in, she told us afterward. I wanted to come in to tell my story because I want other immigrants to stand up for justice, to make their voice heard. It was remarkably inspirational. We see these remarkable. You wonder why I'm so optimistic. You meet people like that who had been victims of unspeakable constitutional violations, and yet they come here with optimism, and they come here determined to make America a better country. And we had another witness to that effect. And that was a remarkable series of incidents, and they were the talk of the courtroom at the end of the day. And so we continue to work with law enforcement agencies to ensure effective constitutional policing that reduces crime, enhances public confidence in law enforcement, and ensures respect for the Constitution. And we will continue to do that in New Orleans and elsewhere. We had to file suit in Arizona because there was evidence of a systemic pattern and practice of constitutional violations, including racial profiling of Latinos and including retaliation against perceived foes of the police department, people who were arrested without cause, jailed in some cases without cause, public leaders who were targeted without cause because they had the audacity to speak out. And when we see these violations, we will not hesitate to take action, which is why the week before last, we sent a letter to Alamance County, North Carolina. If I gave you another quiz, which state has the most 287G agreements? I don't think that North Carolina would be the first on your list, but as of a year ago or so, that was the answer to that question. And again, we worked very vigilantly to gather the evidence, and the evidence demonstrated that Latinos were being targeted in many ways, shapes, and forms. And so we issued that letter of finding. And in both Alamance and in Maricopa County, in the immediate aftermath of our actions, our colleagues at the Department of Homeland Security took immediate action to rescind the agreements that they had with these jurisdictions, to send a very clear signal of the government's very strong opposition to racial profiling. And so we will continue to work with law enforcement agencies across the country. We have great respect for the decision of the court in the Arizona case. We said immediately, the attorney general said immediately afterward, we have great respect and we will follow the law of the land. And we will ensure that racial profiling that we see in the implementation of that law will not be tolerated. And our actions in Alamance County demonstrate that when we see such actions, we will not hesitate to take action. And let me tell you one more anecdote of the last 10 days from our work in the policing context. Many of you may have followed the activities in East Haven, Connecticut. East Haven, Connecticut was an area, 50-member department, a remarkable immigrant community, and a remarkable series of problems between the police and the immigrant community. We had two tracks of operation in that case. In one context, four officers, including a sergeant, were indicted for criminal violations and charged with criminal violations in connection with some of the abuses or the alleged abuses that occurred in Connecticut. And in another case, in a civil context, we filed a letter of finding, again, documenting the persistent pattern and practice of constitutional deprivations, primarily focused on Latinos. And there is a remarkable priest in East Haven who has really shone a light on these issues and has been a real force of courage and action in that community. And fast forward to 10 days ago, the sergeant, one of the defendants in that case, pled guilty to civil rights violations in connection with that case. And to me, most remarkably, 10 days ago, the department hired their first Latino officer. And I should be more specific. They hired a Latina, Spanish-speaking, culturally competent, linguistically proficient, someone who will enable the department to rebuild and repair the relationships with the community. They did not have to compromise quality to address the concerns that we talked about, because diversity and competence go hand in hand. And so we see progress, and we see communities that had been torn apart coming together. And that's why, again, I have such great optimism moving forward. We see opportunity gaps, not simply, though, in the areas I've described, but we see opportunity gaps in the employment setting. We see opportunity gaps in the housing setting. One of my favorite people in the Civil Rights Division is in this audience, Seema Nanda. Seema, can you stand up for just a quick moment, introduce yourself? Seema heads our Office of Special Counsel. Doris, you will remember this office because in the 86 immigration bill, when employer sanctions were passed, there was an understandable and very accurate, it turns out, with hindsight, concern that immigration sanctions would lead to discrimination against foreign-looking and foreign-sounding individuals. And so this office was established, and it is under the able leadership of Seema that this office is now in, I believe, its finest hands ever, because Seema is an incredible leader. And the office is tasked with making sure that people who are foreign-looking and foreign-sounding, legal immigrants, who are here and eligible for work can indeed work. And we work very closely, again, with our colleagues at the Department of Homeland Security, working with USCIS, for instance, making sure that as other programs are rolled out, whether it's E-Verify or other things, that there is no discrimination in the implementation of those programs. And so she has brought partnership to new levels. We help people in big cases. We help people on the phone. We help the immigrant from the Democratic Republic of the Congo who was a refugee. He got his refugee status 2 years ago. He applies for a job. He gets selected for the job. He shows his Social Security number and other indicia of eligibility, and they ask him for more. That's illegal. And Seema and her colleagues are able to help him. And we see those opportunity gaps in the employment context persist and persist. And that's why Seema and her colleagues have never been busier. We see equal housing opportunity elusive. The three largest cases in the history of the Fair Housing Act in residential lending have occurred in the last 9 months. Because all too frequently, the American dream of home ownership has been transformed, regrettably, into an American nightmare through the corrosive power of fine print by unscrupulous lenders who have preyed on immigrant communities. Se habla español, they will say. You get lured in, and then you are given a product that is not the product that you qualify for. And all of the casework that we do involves situations where individuals were qualified for a better product, but they either got steered into a subprime product or another product that would maximize opportunities for individuals, a broker, to maximize his or her commission on that sale, but it would set the individual immigrant up for failure. And that is why we set up a fair lending unit. That's why we've done more work in the fair lending context than ever before. And the two demographic groups that we have helped the most statistically are African Americans and Latinos, because they have been at the epicenter of the unfair and often discriminatory practices that we have seen across the country. And so we will continue the work of our fair lending group to ensure equal housing opportunity for everyone, because we all know one of the most important ways that we accumulate wealth in this country is through home ownership. And if you're set up for failure from the beginning, then you will not get that wealth. And not only that, but it'll be quite the contrary. You'll see your credit rating ruined. You will have so many ancillary consequences, all of which are bad. Communities will see ancillary consequences, all of which are bad, because you will see property values go down. You will see oftentimes crime go up as foreclosures go up and housing is abandoned in communities. And that's why we do so much more in this area now. We do so much more with our state court systems, because access to opportunity remains elusive for way too many people who are trying to access the court system. Under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 64, if you're a recipient of federal financial assistance, as virtually all state courts are across this country, you have an obligation to ensure access to the courts for people who are limited English proficient. And it's not only Title VI that is the source of this requirement. It's really common sense. Because look at the Supreme Court in Georgia. There was a case there recently where a conviction was reversed. The individual was a Chinese national, limited English proficient, very serious crime that he was accused of committing. Took a guilty plea, but there were no translators in the room. And so it got reversed on appeal. Because how can you knowingly and voluntarily waive your rights if you can't understand what's going on? And we've had all too many cases where we have seen in one jurisdiction that shall go unnamed, the prosecutor was translating for the defendant in a courtroom. I don't believe I would call that a best practice. And so we have an entire unit that is working with courts to make sure that access to justice is there. And you know what? The stakes are so high here, because we're talking about cases of child custody, domestic violence, criminal cases, other important civil cases. We got to get this right here. And that's why we're working so hard with state court systems to make sure we get it right. And we're getting so much cooperation. We've been able to work successfully with Rhode Island, Colorado, and other states to make sure that access to justice, again, is not simply a hollow promise in these states. And so I'm very proud of the work that we're doing there. I'm very proud of the work that SEMA and others are doing. I'm very proud of the work that we're doing in the voting context, because voting is one of those fundamental rights. When I get the privilege, and I've had the privilege many times to sit with John Lewis, I am always inspired by his passion. I'm inspired by his sacrifice. I recognize that when he was at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge getting his head beaten up by so many people who wanted to divide our communities, I recognize that we have a job to do. And that's why we have worked so hard in the voting context. And in the voting context, again, we have been able to do so much working in an aggressive but even-handed manner to make sure that our voting rights are enforced across the board. We do a lot of work on behalf of people who are U.S. citizens and are limited English proficient and live in communities where there are critical masses of people with limited English proficiency, and where the local election authorities, as a result, have an obligation to ensure that people in this category can access bilingual ballots. Because if you can't understand the ballot, you can't meaningfully exercise your right to vote. And that's why we do cases in urban areas like Alameda County and in emerging areas like Colfax, Nebraska, immigration is no longer an urban and suburban phenomenon. It is a phenomenon in all 50 states, as you all know. And that's why we continue to work in these areas. We continue to see discrimination, regrettably, in voting context, whether it's in jurisdictions that are not comporting with their requirements under the bilingual ballots provisions of federal law, or whether it's other jurisdictions that have engaged in election processes surrounding redistricting in which they failed to adhere to their obligation to ensure the absence of discriminatory purpose and the absence of discriminatory effect of their work. And that is why we have done more work in filing and dealing with new cases in our voting section in this past year than ever before in our section's history. We just completed a number of trials, most recently South Carolina, but we had cases involving Texas redistricting and a Texas voter ID provision. And in the redistricting case, at the conclusion of the trial, the court, which was composed, parenthetically, of two judges. It's a three-judge panel that hears these cases. Two of the three judges were appointed by Republican presidents. One was appointed by a Democratic president. And this is what they found on the issue of discriminatory intent in the Texas redistricting case. They wrote in a footnote, quote, "The parties have provided more evidence of discriminatory intent than we have space or need to address here." That wasn't my opinion. That was the opinion of the three-judge panel in Texas redistricting. We will continue this work, and we will continue our other voting rights enforcement efforts, because voting rights is what it's all about. It is at the core of who we are as a community, as a society. We will continue these efforts not only during election years, but throughout. We will continue our efforts on behalf of military and overseas voters. And we've done more to assist military and overseas voters over the last 2 years than in any period in the history of the division. We'll continue the work on voter ID laws and other laws, and we will pre-clear them when the facts call for it, as we did in Virginia and New Hampshire, and we will challenge them when the facts and the law call for it, as we did in Texas and South Carolina. We will continue to do that work. And I wanted to give you a lay of the land here, because I know that many of you are focused on some of the subsets of things that we're talking about. You may be a day-to-day immigration practitioner. You may be a professor here. You may be working in government. You may be soon to be not working in government in one case, although that makes me very sad. But for all of you, I think it's important to have this context, because all of these laws that were written were laws that will benefit people that you're serving in this room, because these laws are all about giving people a fair shake. The Attorney General is fond of referring to the Civil Rights Division as a conscience of the federal government, and to these laws that we enforce as a crown jewel of the Department of Justice. They are indeed crown jewels, and that's why I take my job so seriously. That is why we continue our efforts to make sure that we monitor state laws on immigration, that we continue our efforts in the voting context, that we continue our efforts in the immigration context, in the employment context, in the education context, in the housing context, in every civil rights context, because everybody deserves a fair shake. That's what the work we do is all about, making sure people have a fair shake. And we must continue these efforts, and we must continue the discussions that you are going to have today. You know, if I could add one more panel to your work, Doris, at the end of the day, I would add a panel on how to build and rebuild the coalitions that came about. Because I was working for Senator Kennedy in 1995 and 96 during immigration reform. That's when I first had the privilege of seeing the master at work. You know, we had about 80 amendments in the Judiciary Committee that were offered. And I need one hand to count the number of amendments that passed on a party line vote. Immigration has a proud bipartisan history. I know that this president and this attorney general are passionately committed to making comprehensive immigration reform happen. They're looking for partners. They're willing to listen and learn from anyone who has a good idea, not simply members of one party or another. They appreciate that proud bipartisan history. And I hope we can rekindle that, because this work that we're doing is not simply a sprint. This work that we're doing, as our history tells us, is a marathon relay. The baton is in our hands. The baton was once in the hands of the ancient order of Hibernians. And the baton was once in the hand of the German societies and the Lithuanian societies and more recently the Ethiopian societies and the Cameroonian societies. But it is in our hand, this marathon relay of immigrant integration and immigration reform. It's in our hands right now. And it's not simply a civil rights imperative that we get together today, reflect, and think about what we're doing. It is an economic imperative as a nation, because you look at the engine of our economy across this nation and the contributions that immigrants continue to make. And I know Mark understands that, because we've talked about it. We've talked about the moral imperative. We've talked about the economic imperative. We've talked about the law enforcement imperative, the humanitarian imperative, all of these imperatives. The baton is in our hands, and it's up to us to come together, to put party aside, to work together on all of these issues so that we can indeed follow in the proud tradition of Ronald Reagan in 86, Alan Simpson, and my former boss, Ted Kennedy, a decade later. It is time to tackle these issues. I am profoundly and chronically confident that we will, because I know this president is profoundly committed to it. This attorney general is profoundly committed to it. And I hope you have looked at the work of this Justice Department, and you will see that we are profoundly committed. Actions speak louder than words. And you have seen through our actions our commitment to the fair and even-handed enforcement of a wide array of laws, to the active engagement with states, to the active engagement with business leaders and other advocates in this critical area. And I hope that in the end of the day, you will not only learn more about what you're doing in state enforcement, I hope you will learn more about what wonderful people like Seth Grossman and Ali Mayorkas and Barbara Strack are doing from the government end. I hope you will learn more from the wonderful work of advocates who are here today, from the wonderful work of people like Mark and others. I hope you will learn more, and we will redouble our efforts, because the stakes are indeed high. There are too many people who are needlessly suffering right now. There are too many companies who need to expand, but they can't, because our system is currently not capable of accommodating that. And with your help, we will move forward. And I hope you know that the Department of Justice stands on the ready to do what is necessary to ensure that the American dream remains an American dream for everyone, that E Pluribus Unum, as I said earlier, is not simply a hollow Latin phrase that I learned at Canisius High School, but it is indeed a value statement that we live and breathe every single day of our existence. So, Doris, thanks for allowing me to come and say a few words about what we're doing. We're doing is something I am indeed, as I said, very proud of. But I know that we can't do this alone. And I know there are so many people in this audience, local leaders, state leaders, national leaders, faith leaders, who are here to do the job. And I hope that's exactly what you will do. If you ever have any questions, if you ever have any concerns, tom.perez@usdoj.gov. tom.perez@usdoj.gov. Give us your ideas. Give us your wisdom. Give us your feedback. We are here to help. We are here to learn. And we are here to improve the quality of justice across America. Thank you very much.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.